If you can't slow down, then you really don't know what's working, and it's impossible to measure. Companies love to make, I don't know, 8 changes at once. It's just who we are. We just are built with this hardwired thing to introduce a lot of change altogether because we think it's going to be easier for people to adopt and swallow. Well, when you do that, it's impossible to know which change helped.
Hi, welcome to Path to Growth. I'm Tracy Young, co-founder and CEO of TigerEye. Today, we are joined by Mallory Lee, Vice President of Revenue Operations at PhoneBurner. Welcome, Mallory.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So to start, tell us about growing up. Where were you raised? Tell me about your parents. What did you learn from them?
Yeah, I was raised in the Midwest. So I live in Indiana, and I've lived here the majority of my life. And I think, you know, you hear about Midwest values, kind of a cliche out there, but I'm a big believer in, you know, just being kind and getting along with people. And we live out in the suburbs, raising our family. We've got 3 boys. I think I learned a lot about hard work. And I just remember one time my dad telling me that I needed to marry either a doctor or marry a businessman. And that cracked me up and ended up coming true. But I've always been kind of a daddy's girl. So that was a little bit about the past.
What was the thinking behind there? Meant he would be able to take care of his baby girl?
I guess so. I don't know. I think he just knew me better than I knew myself. And I've always been like very type A, firstborn daughter type persona. And so I think I needed to find someone that was similar to myself. And I think he knew that.
Sweet. So talk to us about the Rev Tech Review. How did it start and how's it going?
It's good. It's going fine. You know, the way that this got started was that I continued to see a lot of chatter online, especially on LinkedIn, from founders and CEOs that were almost like arguing with each other in public about who had better data, who had a better platform. And, you know, they were suggesting some of these head-to-head battles and tests to figure out who was better. And I thought, it's not really great for the founders to be the ones doing this analysis. They would put out an analysis that said, we have better data than so-and-so. And it's just very biased coming from that particular company. And so I thought we really need a place to do this kind of review work that is not afraid to share an opinion, not afraid to kind of pick a winner, if you will, but is truly unbiased. You don't work at these places. You don't get paid by these places. You're not a customer that's getting paid to do a review. And so that's how the RevTech Review kind of came to be. And I was just chatting with my friend Molly about it. I said, I think we need something like this. And she said, for sure we do. And so we just started with the writing part. It's been slow and steady. We just do 1 or 2 reviews a week. And we're building up that content repository of tools that we like and what we wish they would put on their roadmap or, you know, who it's a good fit for. And then I think over time, we may get into some of those, you know, industry side-by-sides to give people, you know, just like our true opinion on which one's best.
I love that, you know, the Consumer Reports and Wirecutter would never review the type of technologies that you guys review. And for the listeners hearing about RevTech Review for the first time, quote unquote, it's no bullshit revenue technology reviews by experts, free and unbiased. So you recently joined PhoneBurner as VP of RevOps. What excited you about the role in the company? Tell us more about PhoneBurner.
Yeah, so this is going to be the first time in a long time where I'm working at a company that is profitable. And it sounds funny to say that out loud, but I've been in a lot of these VC-backed, fast-growing businesses that, you know, they were maybe growing fast or they hit a stall. But either way, they weren't making money. And we went through all of the sort of like ZIRP era heartache of how crazy those businesses were. And a lot of cash got spent and then a lot of people lost jobs. And it was just kind of crazy. And you have some maybe interesting VC personalities on the board. And that was a tough period of getting through all that wild situation. So with PhoneBurner, it's interesting. They've been bootstrapped. They're profitable. I loved that about it. And I thought, this feels like I'm growing up and working at like a real business that, you know, makes money. And I thought that that was funny. But I was drawn to the team because they are so smart and so kind. They've got, you know, kind of like their culture is kind and direct. That's what they like to say. And that really resonated with me because I am a direct person, but I am also a kind person. So I thought that was great. And they have a sales dialing technology that can integrate with your CRM or be used as a power dialer. And they've got some really interesting new features coming out in the market, and they're positioned to do really well to help people's calls just get through. You know, sometimes those power dialers, you get marked as spam, your call doesn't actually go through, or you accidentally call the same person 5 times in a row and you don't realize it. So they're in a really good leadership position. So I thought that that just seemed like perfect role.
Yeah, and it sounds like the core values here just really resonated with you, which is important. You made the leap from marketing over to RevOps. Tell us about that progression and what did you learn by, you know, working in both roles?
Yeah, I think that having a marketing background has been really helpful for all things revenue operations, partially because, you know, sales and marketing alignment has always been a priority for marketing operations for the last, you know, more than 10 years. I think that's been like a popular topic of conversation. And so I knew how to be cross-functional. I knew how to get creative and knew how to tell the story of how marketing was supporting sales to, you know, collaborate with them and get buy-in. And I think that that requires a different level of creativity to do a good job measuring marketing performance, whereas a lot of times the sales performance is much more straightforward. So I think it allows people to bring in this left-ish brain thinking side of, you know, measurement, understanding things, process. And then marketers also have that little bit of the right side of the brain where they've got that creativity. So I think those things go together well. And when I first started helping out Terminus, it was a consulting engagement, and they were looking for some help to clarify their sales pipeline. And I said, well, I haven't worked in sales before, but I know how to report on a pipeline and I can figure the rest out. So let's give it a try. And that was the first time that I kind of got into that RevOps world and went ahead and joined full time after a little while, and the rest is history. So I would say it was like a few months later that I took over the RevOps group there. And I had a lot to learn about, you know, territories and comp plans and all things financial, but it's been really cool to grow into that.
Yeah. And one feeds into the other. When we talk about opportunity conversion at the front end of it, it is all campaigns and reads and all the hard work that marketing does. So it's actually a very natural transition, in my opinion, from marketing to revenue operations. You've researched many tools and products. What's a constant that you've observed in RevOps that teams should know about?
I think there's a constant in the need for tools to solve a pain point. And I think the more that we can identify what that is and really embrace it and really go deep on that, the more value that customers will have. And sometimes it's easy to add a bunch of AI features or add a bunch of features that help you compete with, you know, the next guy. And pretty soon you see a little bit of dilution to that main sort of pain point or value prop that you started with. And so I think being just really present with customers, really making sure you understand what their pains are and how to like truly deeply solve those is the best way to add value and be recognized for the value that you're bringing to the organization. And a lot of the sales technology, especially, it's become this arm race of, you know, we do this feature and we do this feature and you can cancel this tool and just use our tool because we do all the same features that they do. And sometimes that's just very confusing for customers. I think ultimately a lot of people buying revenue technology are just confused about who does what, who specializes in what, And what's the purpose of using all of these platforms and getting them to talk to each other?
And usually in RevOps and the projects that RevOps takes on, there's usually an executive sponsor. And there's sort of this priority of tools that get deployed and the architecture and infrastructure gets put in place. But always, always, it's the pain point that is crucially important. Or else why are we deploying software and tools?
It's a great question. And I think sometimes people get very infatuated with the idea that they can help something that, you know, maybe help serve an underserved team or help with efficiency or help save time. And often that's not a strong enough value prop for especially RevOps to take something on, because we're used to being overloaded. We're used to being inundated. It's not a strong enough argument to get us to spend money to say, hey, we're going to save you time. There has to be more to that. And the pain point has to be surfaced of, all right, Mrs. RevOps, I'm going to help you solve your CRO's XYZ problem. I'm going to help you solve your CEO's ABC problem. Because RevOps people especially, they've got to internalize those larger pain points in the business as their own. And it's a little bit of that sort of, you know, servant leadership role where you kind of are putting other people first. And so I think that's important to just tie it all the way back to the revenue gaps or the revenue leak or, you know, the visibility that people are really looking for in their businesses.
What do other teams within go-to-market get wrong about revenue operations? What do they not understand? Or if you can wave the magic wand and you're like, hey, marketing, sales, management, and sales reps, even finance, you have to understand this about revenue operations.
I think I could answer that a couple ways. I also have something I wish that they would understand about themselves. Maybe I'll start with that one.
Well, yeah, let's hear that.
Okay, so I have often done these cross-functional meetings called a pipeline council where we get sales and marketing and CS all together, talk about demand gen, talk about the pipeline, what's working and what's not. And what I wish people would understand is that if you can't slow down and figure out how to do things the same way, then you really don't know what's working and it's impossible to measure. And I can put in as many new sales processes as you want, but if we're not even sure if people follow it, we can't actually measure if we're improving and why we're improving. Also, companies love to make, I don't know, 8 changes at once. It's just who we are. We just are built with this hardwired thing to introduce a lot of change altogether because we think it's going to be easier for people to adopt and swallow. Well, when you do that, it's impossible to know which change helped. And so I wish people would have the ability to slow down just a tiny bit and try to test one thing at a time. Get a uniform process, test one thing, see if it works, go back and test another thing. And it doesn't even have to be a long test. It could be a couple of weeks. But if we isolate the variables and use that sort of almost like scientific process to try to understand what's working and what's not, I think we would have a lot more clarity in making decisions. Because what normally happens is you come together and you say, well, we got 10% more leads. And it could be because we spent more money. It could be because we redefined our MQL definition. It could be because we hired another salesperson who's great. And everything happens at once and there's no clarity. So I just want people to have that clarity. And I think it's important for them to understand what that takes because it's not easy to do. And that's something that I like to preach to people. It's like, okay, let's take a breath. Let's see what's working. Let's make sure we're on the same page.
And as you're speaking, I'm getting almost PTSD thinking about my old work. I got the privilege of getting acquired into a public company. And at that time, they were forming a new business unit and they had acquired four startups and jammed it into one. And so for the first year, you can imagine there's 4 sales team selling to the same industry. And so just to make sure that we weren't stepping on each other's toes, we double bubbled. We double just like just sell, cross sell each other's products, and we're just going to double comp everyone. And you can make a lot of money this year as a sales rep. And 2 quarters go by. And this is at that point, I don't know, this is public. So like $200, almost $300 million business. And the first two quarters, we had only cross-sold like $10,000, something in the five figures. And it's like, how could this be? I was talking to all the reps, and it's just really hard to change muscle memory. And this is the challenge with trying to deploy eight new initiatives at once that affects how people work day to day, because people are always going to lean back to what they're used to, what worked before, how they worked before, how they sold before. And, you know, if there is a process change, there just needs to be a lot of training and strategic intention on getting people to do this new thing. Because
absolutely.
Because our instincts is to not do this new thing. Our instincts is to do what worked last time in the years before. And I totally understand when you talk about the importance of making sure everyone's following the same processes so that you can actually compare apples to apples. And that's a really good point to point out. And I feel like RevOps is always in the middle of it. Same with marketing operations as well.
Yeah, usually.
What are some ways marketing and sales can work more effectively together?
I think the teams that have the hardest time working together probably have limited resources, and they are probably trying to figure out how to allocate resources, and they're spending a lot of time keeping score. And I think that is a super difficult process because people don't buy in a black and white way. You know, we've seen the data that it takes like 8 million touches to get an opportunity and then 27 million more to close it. And it's just such a long journey. And it's the buyer who is in charge of that journey, not us, because everything's so widely available to them. And so when I think about attribution or measuring return on investment and trying to decide how to deploy dollars, I think sales and marketing get on different pages when they're competing for credit on who brought in the customer, who did the best job, who should get this budget or this, you know, team size gets to grow. And comp plans can be inadvertently designed to make that worse. And I think that when comp plans are not necessarily, you know, incentivizing the right stuff, that can pretty quickly pit people against each other. And I experienced that a lot way back in the day at Exact Target, actually. Some of our marketers were paid on opportunities with lead sources that matched their function. And so I spent half of my day as a marketing operations analyst trying to give people credit so they could get their bonus. And it totally distracted us from the work that really needed to be done. And so I've always taken that as a lesson. Like you mentioned, when you have these mergers, you tend to just double comp because you want to eliminate the need for people to bicker with each other. And you just want them to work on the stuff that's important. So I view it the same way for sales and marketing attribution. My goal is to always get the complete picture of how we found them, but then what happened in between. You know, did we have an executive involved in the deal to help get it done? I want to try to see as much of that story as I can and not necessarily give credit to one thing or the other, but more so try to figure out what's the best order for us to do these things in. Do webinars work better before the opportunity gets created or after the opportunity gets created? It doesn't mean we're going to do less webinars. We just want to orchestrate when they help the buying process the most. And so I try to think about marketing attribution that way to avoid some of the headaches of sales versus marketing.
What about you talk about setting the right comp plans because they really drive all behavior? What do you like seeing with marketing? Well, sales, obviously, there's always a number and there's some variable component. What about marketing? Should it be completely aligned with, you know, the sales goals?
Most of the time, I think it should be completely aligned. I think if you're sharing a revenue number, that's really important. And I think that the revenue number should ultimately be the guiding, you know, sort of North Star. But I am also still a fan of making sure that marketing goals are up the funnel as well, because you need to keep certain metrics on pace to have the ability to get it all the way through the funnel. And so what is a pet peeve of mine is when marketers will say, well, I'm compensated on revenue and nothing else. And that's, you know, that's all I care about. But revenue doesn't just come out of thin air. You know, there's still a demand process that takes place to get that revenue. So we can't stop thinking about lead flow and opportunity flow and opportunity conversion. We can make sure that that's not the thing that determines our paycheck, but we still have to have goals for that. We still have to know how we're performing and where to optimize to get a more efficient funnel. So I think marketers who have, you know, maybe a bonus or something that's just based on hitting a lead number, that's probably not the way to go. But also marketers who are only focused on this output of revenue are probably missing the opportunity to analyze what is getting the revenue created. So I think it's got to be a balance of both. But I do like it when sales and marketing have that same overarching revenue number that they're chasing, and you've got those leaders kind of owning that together.
You've shared openly that you're a working mom with your own business. What strategies have helped you stay present with your three boys in both professional and personal time? How do you make it work? Because obviously being mom and being VP of RevOps at a grown startup is really hard.
It is hard. And I don't think I have it figured out. I think it's really difficult some days and a little bit easier other days. One thing that has always been really important to me is to work in a business where my employer can support my situation, and not in a begrudging way, but in like a happy way. Like, wow, you've got three kids. You know, we like kids. Bring them on the camera, you know? And I think that's really important. And you can get a feel for, you know, hopefully you can get a feel during the interview process if people are going to embrace a little bit of that or if they're not. And some days, you know, somebody is sick and they're home and you just make it work and you just multitask. And I do attempt to decrease my multitasking where I can. So I really enjoy getting up early on Saturday when I can do it and doing a little bit of work before breakfast starts and before the day starts and trying to get ahead of things. But once, you know, it's breakfast time and the kids are all up and it's the weekend, I try to keep everything shut and really take advantage of those weekends because they're so precious. And there's a lot of laundry and that takes a lot of time too. But, you know, it's just back and forth and trying to fit it all in. And, you know, having a really good partner at home sure helps a lot.
That is true. I think that is the best advice we could give anyone who's thinking about starting a family, is just to choose the right partner, especially in today's time. If you know, it's really helpful when there is a feminist dad who is going to take on 50% of the childcare and household duties. I've got that too. So that's the only way I make it work. And my parents also live with me. So that's like grandparents for the win.
Oh, absolutely. That's a dream. I like it.
Yeah. The other thing we do is we have a really strict schedule. I've got three kids too. And the three kids sleep in the same room. So it's like 7:30. Their teeth are brushed. You're all going to bed. I don't care if you're not tired. You're just going to go to bed and just be quiet. You're going to fall asleep in 30 minutes. And what's really nice about that is after 8 o'clock, it's our time. We can use it to catch up with work. We can use it to talk about work. We can use it to do whatever we want, right? And it's just so nice to have undivided attention on whatever we want to catch up on versus, I don't know, trying to take care of a cranky kid. Yeah. And they wake up the same time, lunch is at the same time, breakfast is the same time, bath time's the same time. And I feel like my kids really thrive from that. They just know, they're just like, wait, it's 6 o'clock, it's dinner time. Like, we need to clean up and go eat dinner. Yeah. So that's been helpful for us.
That's a great point. I think that when the sports and activities started to really ramp up, that was a whole new experience for us, was like having to be somewhere, you know, 3 or 4 nights a week. And they don't all play the same sports and it's just kind of all over the map. So that makes it harder to keep the schedule. But we do have this, you know, shared family Google Calendar, and we have to live and die by what is on there, because it's very easy to forget something or accidentally be, you know, 10 minutes late to something because, you know, they have karate and it starts at 6:50 instead of 6:30 or 7, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, like to the minute we're living and dying by the Google Calendar.
What's your other advice for working moms thinking about, you know, climbing the ladder and being good parents and good everything else in life?
I have one other tip, and then I'd love to get, I have a question for you actually. So recently over the summer, I got to be part of a cool campaign where they picked some leaders and put their pictures on the NASDAQ board in Times Square. And it was, you know, it was done by Adyo. It was just kind of random. And they just asked me to be part of it. And I said, sure. And at first I didn't believe it was real. They're like, oh, we're going to get a billboard. And I was like, okay, sure. But it did end up happening. And so what we did is we took a trip and we took the kids to see it. And they loved that. And so I tried to really embrace being, you know, proud of like, hey, let's go see mommy's, you know, work. And look at that. You know, my face looks huge in Times Square. And that's, you know, because mommy works hard. And I think that it helped connect a few dots for them. And they thought that that was cool. So, you know, not being shy about being proud of yourself and showing them that working hard can make you feel good and helps you, you know, have the luxuries that you want or whatever. You know, we try to instill that hard work early with them. So that would be one tip, is to not like hide from it, but rather probably embrace it a little. And then my other tip is a question for you. I've been hearing a little more about the differences between men and women. And even if you have an awesome partner who is, you know, strong dad, very present, let's say a kid is sick and he needs to work from home and he's totally willing to do that. What I've kind of heard is that when it's happening to us ladies, the moms, we're like, oh, so-and-so is sick. I need to work from home. I'll be offline from, you know, 11:30 to 12 to do lunch and I'll be around. I'll be doing these things. And we share just all about it. And then the alternative is that dad, he's like, yo, I'm working from home today. I'll be available. And that's it. Says no more. And I think that I noticed myself doing that. I tend to really share a lot about what is happening. And I've actually received advice that is a little bit along the lines of like, you don't have to share all of that. You can just say, I'm working from home. And because guys don't share all of it, it's perceived as like less of an impact to their life. And so I'm curious if you've seen that, because I haven't decided how I feel about this advice. I'm normally pretty open, but maybe, I don't know, maybe there's something to it.
Yeah, it's so funny. We're headed into flu season right now. So all the young kids, as all the parents know, are just getting sick and then, you know, bringing home all their germs.
I think it really depends on the company culture. We try to lead by example. If our kids are sick and we're just like not online, it's like, look, two kids, 102 fever, we're out. Like, we'll be back when they go to sleep, but like, just don't expect us.
Because I think it is really, really hard to split your attention that way. And we would prefer that instead of being disappointed in each other because we're not being responsive or we're not working fast enough or whatever it might be, that at least we have an understanding that, you know, like, hey, there's like there's a really sick kid at home that we're just trying to make sure doesn't end up in the hospital. So I lean towards, and maybe it's because I'm a woman, I do lean towards, you know, just oversharing. And I think what we've seen is that the team is just very upfront about what's happening in their lives. Cause it's not just sick kids, it's sick parents, right? It's we're all dealing with aging and sickness and that happens. And so, and maybe that has given a good example for our male colleagues to also share. It's very embedded in our culture. We are very supportive of parents since the founders are our new parents. We're remote. We have a flexible work schedule. So there's 6 hours of overlap and everyone's like everywhere in the world. So 6 hours of overlap. And then the other 2 or 3 hours, like for me, it might be 8 o'clock that I'm still looking, you know, catching up with emails at night. And for other people, it might be 1 a.m. in the morning when they're programming because it's just when they're more awake. And then for others, it might be like 6 a.m. just because whatever, they get up early. You know when you are most energetic and when you have like, dedicated time to think about work. And so go figure out your schedule. But these 6 hours, we're here for each other. But I agree. I do think women are really good at sharing. And I think something biological, men are less so. Or maybe it's cultural also.
Yeah.
But I think you should share. I think it's like, you know, I would feel really good if we were working together. I would feel really bad for you if all three of your kids were sick and you had to go take care of them. It's like, oh man, that sucks.
Yes. Likewise. You want to have that sympathy for people.
Yeah. It's especially in November and December and January when it just sucks. Everyone is sick. Building their immune system. Okay, let's switch gears a bit. Trust in leaders can be made or broken when things get tough. How do you deal with a crisis?
Well, I think for sure you need to stay calm. And that can be easier said than done. I'm lucky that I've always been like hard to rattle. I'm a calm person. And I get comments about that all the time. Like, you're never worried about stuff, you know? And I might be a little more worried than I let on sometimes, but I do think people need a leader who is not going to freak out. A lot of people learn to not freak out because they've started to see a lot. It's like, oh, I saw this at my last company. Like, this is a crisis, but we will figure it out. And so you have to give people that confidence that they know how to solve problems, they know how to make a difference and get things done and keep a cool sort of head. And then I think just a lot of communication, a lot of over-communication, especially if you have a crisis that impacts your customers in some way and they're looking for updates, even internally. Lack of updates is probably one of the worst problems during tough times. So being, you know, free and open with the progress, I think is important.
And really communicative about what's happening. So people don't worry, you know, maybe they are worried, but at least you're bringing them along in the journey.
Absolutely.
Tell us about one person who's helped you become the leader you are today.
I'm sure I was supposed to think about this ahead of time. I think one person that has really helped me over the years and across like multiple jobs and multiple roles is my friend Tim, and he was the CMO at ExactTarget. So he was my first boss's boss, and he was part of the interview process, and he's gained, you know, a really great following, well known for being a master at brand and demand. And then he was the CEO at Terminus, and he's been a mentor for me, but he's also been an advocate for me. And I think those can be two different things, and often they are different things, but, you know, he's always been one to pull me in and rely on me for help, but then be a teacher at the same time. And I think that has opened so many unique doors for me over the years. And my last two full-time roles that I've, you know, gotten myself into were not coming from his connections or his world. And I just remembered thinking, you know, this is strange that I'm, you know, finally now doing all of this without him. And I was a little bit sad about it and then a little bit proud of it. And, you know, I don't really, quote unquote, like need him to be my advocate anymore after all these years. But I know that he still would if I needed anything. And so he's just always been a fantastic example of someone who thinks strategically and knows how to invest correctly to grow a business and, you know, very big focus on his family as well.
So he modeled that as an example for you. I think it's really powerful when someone you respect and look up to is just hands you over projects and looks you in the eye and says, you can do this. And if you run into problems, like this is what I would do, or just coaching you through it. And it's has this power to it, that belief in building that trust in yourself that might not have been there before. You know, before those conversations and before those projects. Last question, I can talk to you for much longer.
What parting advice do you have for our listeners who are all, you know, in the go-to-market space, coming up in their careers? Many of them are women. What's your parting advice, Bidan?
I would say when it comes to being a leader within go-to-market, and especially within operations, we are sometimes the only people who are truly able to see from A to Z across that customer journey. And if you can lean into the cross-functional nature of your job and really help people get aligned and stay aligned across the different go-to-market teams, it will become very clear that you are thinking strategically about the entire journey. And there's not enough of that because, you know, we hire great marketers to be laser focused on marketing and great sales leaders to be laser focused on sales, and rightfully so. And so being able to spend that time knitting things together and helping people see around corners and just being as proactive as you can be, I think it makes a big difference. And that can be found in, you know, measuring handoffs, measuring our ability to get data from sales to onboarding, measuring how long it takes us to get somebody onboarded when we've got, you know, great handoff and when we have bad handoff, and helping people see how everything fits together and really leaning into that sort of like cross-functional collaboration has been a great way for myself, I think personally, to just learn the whole business and try to be that operator that can help support a company as a whole.
Be really curious about the other departments that are adjacent to you. I don't think we do enough of that either.
Yeah, learning as much as you can, you know, helping connect people who should be connected, but they're not. Like, oh, I heard that you're doing this and you should go talk to Tracy because she's got something very similar going on. You know, people are really grateful for that alignment, because when you're not aligned, I think is when you end up just wasting time, and yeah. Time, you know, time is money. So I think it's a good area of focus.
Yeah. And you gain just a wider lens of a perspective on everything that's, you know, ultimately with what we're trying to make the business more profitable.
For sure.
Mallory, it was so great talking to you. Thank you for sharing all your wisdom and nuggets of advice. I'm sure our listeners had a great time joining us today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.